Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
When someone offers you drugs, only one of two people can control the situation. The one with the drugs, or you. And if you want to keep control, you can do several things to turn drugs down. Like just walking away, changing the subject, avoiding the whole situation altogether, or by sticking around with a crowd that doesn't do drugs. Saying no to drugs is a matter of control. And that control belongs in your hands, not somebody else's.
For information, call Dare America.
That's actor Kirk Cameron in a 1989 PSA for the anti-drug program DARE. DARE started in L.A. back in 1983. Now critics question whether it does more harm than good. We'll talk about that later in the show. But first, a former teacher and head of the English department at the prestigious Marlboro School for Girls has been charged with four felony sex crimes. Joseph Ketters left the Marlboro School because of allegations of inappropriate behavior toward a student. He was briefly hired by Pasadena's Polytechnic School. Since then, many former Marlboro students have come forward to describe inappropriate relationships with Ketters. One former student says she had a one-year sexual relationship with him, starting when she was 16 years old and ending with her becoming pregnant in her senior year. She later miscarried. Evgenia Peretz has written an in-depth piece about this story for Vanity Fair magazine, where she's a contributing editor. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. This all began last year when a former student wrote an essay in the online magazine Exo Jane. Tell us about what she said and how that broke open this story.
Well, she posted this woman, Michaela Gilbert-Laurie. She's now a sophomore at UPenn. She posted an article about a flirtation she had with an unnamed teacher at an unnamed school. So she didn't say that this was Marlboro, but she described this flirtation that she had with a teacher, her English teacher, that soon became very uncomfortable for her. She did sort of have a crush on him at the beginning, and then she was interviewing him for the school paper, and they started this very flirtatious email correspondence and would meet in private. And then at one point, he put his hand on her knee, and she got very uncomfortable, and she went to the head of the school to complain about it, and she felt that the school didn't really do enough, that he was just given counseling and that they kind of, you know, brush it under the rug. So that was, you know, it could have just gone away, but many readers that sort of went viral among Marlboro grads recognized who she was talking about. And soon more girls were coming forward with very similar stories.
Similar stories that were just a flirtation or something more?
Basically, at that point, it was just flirtatious stuff, inappropriate comments, a hand placed on a knee, that sort of thing. But then there was one girl who, after she read this, she contacted Michaela, and this is a woman who I interviewed for my article. She's the one that you're referring to. She had the sexual affair with him. It took her a while to really come out with her story, and she still hasn't given her name.
Okay. And you're calling her Holly in your story.
Yeah.
And she talks about how this hand on the knee then progressed to them meeting in private and then having this full-blown sexual relationship.
Yeah. I mean, the pattern with her started in the same way it did with the other girls. It was ostensibly about the work that they were doing. She was writing a Hamlet paper and struggling with it, and he suggested that they meet in private, and they continued this flirtation and started going to his house when his wife was at work, and he professed his love to her, and soon they were sleeping together.
And she obviously didn't tell the school about this at the time, but another student, not just Michaela, told the school about feeling uncomfortable around him, and the school didn't do anything?
Yes. There was another girl who told the head of the school that something had happened, something inappropriate had happened to her. And at the time, the head of the school, Barbara Wagner, didn't believe it was important or credible. It's unclear. It certainly didn't rise to the level of sex. I would say it was more along the lines of Michaela's story.
Mm-hmm. And so now Barbara Wagner has stepped down, and she was, you know, from all accounts, much beloved at Marlboro as a wonderful leader and a great educator. But she took responsibility for this?
One of the main thrusts of my article is really about the investigation that the special committee, so this was a special committee comprised of board members, they conducted this investigation, which has been very, very controversial at the school, and a lot of alums and parents are furious at this investigation because it pinned all the blame on Barbara Wagner, and certainly she did not behave perfectly. You know, like I said, when someone complained to her in 2005, she didn't give that credence, and obviously that's not okay. But a lot of these parents feel that there were many events that were sort of obfuscated in the report on the investigation, and they felt like someone's head had her role, and they were picking this woman who had done so much for the school, and really there was quite a lot of blame to go around about why this teacher was still there.
Because they didn't actually have a policy to deal
with
this.
That's right.
There
was no, I mean, it's kind of strange to think that at an all-girls school, there would be no policy. But there was no policy. And, I mean, it's sort of debatable whose responsibility is to create that policy. But there was a board of trustees, and one would think that it would have been their responsibility to say, hey, we need a policy for this sort of thing. But there was none in place.
So the board president, John Emerson, who is now the ambassador to Germany, you write in your piece that he had worked for Gary Hart, he had worked for Bill Clinton, and so perhaps had an understanding of what this kind of sex scandal could do.
Yes, yes. So basically what happened was when this girl, Michaela Gilbert-Lurie, came to speak with Barbara Wagner about what happened, Barbara Wagner then spoke with the president of the Board of Trustees. That was John Emerson. And he said, well, we don't need to inform the rest of the board. Let's just handle this ourselves, handle it internally. And he advised her on a number of steps that should be taken. And, you know, that was counseling and stripping the teacher of his English department chair. But the interesting thing is that his involvement was completely left out of the board's own report. So this is what people are so upset about. Many people feel like he was culpable and that he was just being sort of let off the hook and that Barbara Wagner was taking the fall.
Now, is this before or after Holly's story came forward, the girl who was impregnated?
Well, no one really, I mean, the board has known about Holly's story since she wrote a letter to the school over the summer. So they have known about it since they started their investigation.
And by that time, Ketters was gone.
Yes, Ketters was gone at that point. So after Holly read Michaela's article, she wrote a letter to the school saying what had happened. She spoke with Barbara Wagner. Barbara Wagner said that she would need to file a police report. So they did. And so the committee of the board looking into this, they knew Holly's story, but the rest of the school community had no idea. And even when they issued their report, they really gloss over her story. They call it an episode of inappropriate physical conduct when it was in fact getting a minor pregnant.
Statutory rape.
Yeah.
So now Ketters has been charged with four felony counts of sex crimes. Is this in relation to the Holly case?
Yes, I believe it's mainly based on that. But I didn't have access to the detectives, but from my understanding, yes.
Is that what her attorney is saying?
Yes, yes.
David Ring.
Yeah.
Is there some irony and some sad irony to the fact that this is a school that teaches young women to be independent, strong, stand up for themselves, to be equal partners to men? It's an all-girls school, after all. That the allegations by these students were not taken seriously.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an irony. That's one thing that Holly says is for all that the school taught her to stick her neck out and be strong, she didn't feel like she could do that. And, you know, I'm not saying that that's necessarily the fault of the school, but it is kind of remarkable that there wasn't a place to say this is happening and that it wasn't really on the radar.
Well, it certainly is now.
Yes, yes.
Evgenia Peretz, contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine, where she's written an article about the Marlboro School sex abuse scandal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, have you ever experienced any unwelcome advances from a teacher? Call us, share your story if you'd like. 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up on the show, for young Black men in Los Angeles, the number one cause of death is murder. One reason murders of Black men are not solved at a high rate. We'll find out why next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 260 people were murdered in the city of Los Angeles last year. Nearly half of those victims were Black. Half. And that's despite the fact that Blacks make up only 8% of LA's population. South LA is ground zero for the epidemic of Black murder in Los Angeles. Most cases there are never solved. And that lack of justice has escalated the murder problem, according to a new book by crime journalist Jill Leovi. The book is called Ghettocide, A True Story of Murder in America. And when I spoke with Jill Leovi, I started by asking her about those left behind after a homicide, about the blanket of grief that smothers South Los Angeles.
It really will spin you. It'll blow your mind what's out there. I mean, many, many times in the course of looking for a family or a mother, I would knock on another door, and the person I talked to would say, well, I lost my son, too. I met a number of people who had lost more than one child to homicide. It's pretty unimaginable. I do a lot of canvas work where I knock on doors, and I found streets where maybe not the whole street, but maybe one side of the street, everyone had lost somebody in their family to homicide.
You describe homicide eyes. People whose child was killed have this vacant look in their eyes.
Yes, it's actually more affecting to behold that in some ways than if people are emoting in a very obvious way. People are very quiet. But, you know, they shake a lot. They have trouble speaking a lot. It's almost as if it's hard for them to get the words out.
Does having a conviction help with that?
It may not help with the grief long term, but I can tell you this. For those who lost a son or a daughter or a husband or a brother, and it's not covered in any newspaper, and the sense they have is that the police investigation came and went in a flash, or maybe even a police officer at the scene said, was your son a gang member? And that stuck with them. And then the case goes unsolved, and the detective is transferred to another function, and the next time they call, nobody immediately knows what case they're talking about. That is terrible. It's a terrible kind of diminishing sense that the world has erased you and erased, you know, what you care about. And I think it has a deep and lingering effect. People I met would talk about homicides of generations past, and they would still remember they were unsolved in the family, and they would remain embittered by it.
So you spent years embedded with the police in South LA. And your book, you focus on one detective in particular. His name is John Skaggs. And he is big, tall, white, blondish, as you describe him, and an unlikely figure in South LA because he's a police officer who took his job very, very seriously, and the residents there respected him. Can you describe him?
Very perfectionist, takes a lot of pride in how he presents himself, how he appears. He always wore these sort of clean, starched white shirts and washed his car all the time. All the detectives in that unit in Watts had various creeds about starting very early, skipping lunch, being neat and clean. It was not considered okay to leave stacks of paper on your desk the way office workers often do, because there's so many cases that anything like that that suggests you're falling behind was taboo. I think John Skaggs typifies some of the qualities that make successful homicide detectives. It's an interesting type.
And I wonder if you could talk about one of the victims you focus on in the book. His name is Bryant Tonelli. And he was shot down one day as he was walking down the street, young man, teenager. What happened to him? Tell us his story.
It's not really clear, but it may just be that he was wearing the wrong clothes and he was mistaken for a gang combatant, which he was not. He had nothing to do with any of it. He was a graduate of a local Catholic school and the son of a police officer. Many, many of these victims are what I would call noncombatants. People don't realize so many of them are shot in circumstances that really have more to do with just being a likely target in a neighborhood where there's some kind of gang fight going on. All of these victims, I believe, deserve attention, but people would be amazed how many people like Bryant Tonelli are being lost.
Bryant Tonelli was different because he was the son of a police officer. And so he had a lot more attention focused on him. His crime had a lot more attention within the police department. And yet he wasn't different because he was another young black man who was gunned down in South L.A.
Yeah. The part of the reason I wrote about Bryant is he's absolutely a very typical victim. 18 years old. That's kind of the age where it starts.
And it wasn't going to be solved until John Skaggs came in. Why?
One of the key breaks in the case involved interviewing one of the witnesses who had denied knowledge, I think it was a fourth time, and it was only on the fourth time that this person offered the evidence that later corroborated with other evidence and cracked the case. So that took a great deal of sort of relentless focus and interviewing the same person over and over. Skaggs' story is intended to demonstrate is how expensive it is, how difficult it is, how much support is needed.
Because he works overtime and that's paid out.
The overtime, or just that example I gave. I mean, that to go back and back and back and sit with a witness and ask again and again is much more expensive and much more difficult than simply asking them once. And that's what it takes in this environment.
And meanwhile, the other homicides are piling up.
And meanwhile,
the
other homicides are piling up, exactly.
Now, from the Watts riots, both sets, I guess, of Watts riots, we have this image of the white police officer as someone who is decidedly unwelcome in that neighborhood in parts of Los Angeles, which are majority black. But he was different. The residents there really respected him.
You know, I would characterize the relationship between black residents of Watts, especially in their police, is actually much more complicated than that. It's a relationship that's filled with both hostility and intimacy. And in terms of his relationship with that community, the job he did allowed him to relate to people in Watts in a very different way, because homicide is an extremely unique thing, and it sort of opens up a world in policing that's very different than some of the other worlds that officers in different functions experience.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jill Leovi. She has a new book. It's called Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. The cleared caseload, the average percentage of cases closed, homicide cases closed, meaning solved, is less than 40%?
Yes.
And the primary reason for that is that witnesses won't testify?
The witness fear problem is, as I say in my book, absolutely colossal. It is every single witness on every single case. People are terrified to talk. Witnesses do sometimes get attacked. I would say it's rare. But much more common is very low-level intimidation that carries a heavy meaning, because there is so much violence in these neighborhoods. So if, particularly if you're a young black man and you're being getting hard stares from the gang down the block, I mean, you're right to take that seriously. It's scary.
So the witnesses refuse to testify, even though, as you say, as you quote in the book, everybody knows when one of these homicides occur, they occur in broad daylight often. There are a lot of witnesses, and then news travels fast as to who did it. And it's a relatively small community, so people know each other. Everybody knows.
Yeah, well, it's rumors fly freely. It's that's an important point about this, and I think an important clue to what's happening. Why aren't the homicides committed in a more secret manner? Well, the reason is because they serve a purpose, and they enforce a kind of order. They are public events because they're expressing a system of public order that's an alternate system to the state justice that people feel have failed them.
So your argument in the book is that this alternate system of justice has arisen in the absence of the regular system of justice, and that because the criminal justice system, the policing apparatus, has so failed to prosecute these crimes and to arrest people, that this other alternate form of justice has arisen.
And the factor that makes this all so poisonous is hyper-segregation, the idea that this is happening in a very concentrated way in a small area where people are not very mobile. And that's partly an artifact of very high levels of black-white residential segregation. But one of the things that really got me interested in this, if you looked at other contexts, other high homicide environments around the world, different kinds of people, that these very familiar patterns emerge. One is petty arguments dominating the homicide numbers. And it's so damaging because there's a tendency to look at that and say, look at these people, they're fighting over the smallest things. Well, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. If you think about, you know, what if your fifth grade teacher told all the students, you all can do whatever you want to each other, no one will get in trouble, and then locked you in that room for a year, and what the bullies would do and how the other students would respond and whether they would group up together for protection. All of this stuff is actually quite human and I think a kind of a default setting for us.
Well, also, it seems counterintuitive to the narrative that we have now that in black communities there's too much policing, that there are too many instances of harassment of police coming and arresting people for nothing, for just generally rousting them for no reason. And sometimes that can end up deadly in the case of Eric Garner in Staten Island. But you're saying that it's a different kind of policing that's missing.
Yeah, I think there's it's too much policing and too little at the same time. It's too little of good policing, and it's too much of the policing that tends to jeopardize trust in these communities. And by good policing, I would say that effective investigations where you actually find who did it, and especially when it's murder and violence, which are very different than anything else, and really affect the facts on the ground in a different way, that if you solve those crimes and find the killer, and the killer is tried and convicted, that is a justice-building act, whereas sweeps, stopping and searching people is something that, to the masses of people who are affected by it, and by there's way more of them than there are of killers, feels like harassment. It feels like control. One of the things I talk about in the book, I think we've really been besotted with the idea of preventing crime and police being predictive. And I really do think we have to rethink that.
Well, I wonder if you could go into that a little bit more, because that is something that a lot of people are in favor of on the left as well, that there should be a lot of emphasis placed on providing more resources so that young black men aren't hanging out in places where they can either shoot or be shot.
Well, what does that mean? What does that mean when we talk about preventive policing? What are those police actually doing in their daily work? Well, they're stopping and searching people, which, you know, on the other side of that, people object to that. And yet they want to support these sort of saturation policing methods. They're not like putting the dots together. What do you think those police are doing when you simply deploy them at random in a way that's not in direct response to a crime? Prevention is very, very seductive. But I think we need to stop and think about its application to law. What is law? What is law really about? It is not hygiene. It's not about washing hands to prevent disease. Law is about the acts that individuals commit. It's about acts, and I think if we focus on acts, that's also inoculation against discrimination.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Jill Leovi. She has a new book out. It's called Ghettocide, A True Story of Murder in America. And coming up on the program, it's California law that school children must have a certain amount of PE, but it's not exactly a priority at many schools, how a lawsuit is trying to change that, and should computer coding count as a foreign language requirement? Those stories are next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Elementary school children in California are required to have 200 minutes of PE every 10 days, or roughly 20 minutes a day. But in these days of budget cuts and test prep, PE is often seen as an unaffordable extra, something that gets squeezed out. Well, a nonprofit group called Cal 200 for those 200 minutes of exercise kids are supposed to get, is now suing school districts across the state. 37 districts, including LAUSD, have agreed to a settlement, which a judge is expected to approve next month. Don Driscoll is mounting that lawsuit. He's a lawyer in private practice. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first, what does this settlement involve?
It involves making sure that physical education is really provided. There's a lot of pressure on teachers to do a lot of different things, and especially with standardized testing, there's a focus on that aspect of school. And unfortunately, that detracts from everything else. And what we're doing here is trying to make sure that the schools communicate to their teachers that they really do care about physical education, that the teachers record what they do, that the principals really make sure it's happening, that the school districts report on their compliance. All that should add up to a much better situation than currently exists. Pretty much everyone agrees that kids ought to get exercise and they ought to have physical education. And one of the good things in bringing this lawsuit has been it's really brought to school districts' attention the need to focus a bit more on this. We haven't had any school district that said, you know, we really don't think physical education is good for the kids. We really don't want to do this. It's all been about how to do it.
So your lawsuit is going to tell them how to do it? I mean, don't they, if they already know that they need to do this, but they just aren't because, well, there aren't enough minutes in the day to do everything, how is your lawsuit going to change anything?
I think there are enough minutes in the day to do this. When you're under pressure to get things done, there's a tendency to just keep doing it and to forget that you need to take breaks. And certainly, studies show that kids learn more when you give them breaks for physical activity. So I don't think the physical education makes it harder for teachers to get their job done. In the end, it makes it easier for them to get it done. It's just that challenge when we have something to do and we need to get it done to say, wait a minute, the fastest way to get it done is not just to push, push, push.
So you're saying in order to for them to do better on standardized tests, they need to take breaks, and those breaks should be PE?
Well, I think they should take breaks, and yes, that will help with standardized tests, but that's far from the only reason for PE. This California state legislature has been very concerned with overweight kids and how kids are spending more time sitting than they ever have been. And in 2002, the legislature clearly renewed the 200-minute requirement out of health concerns. I think those health concerns are very important.
So what's the situation now? Is it kind of ad hoc? Like if a teacher wants to do it, they'll do it? They'll give their kids 20 minutes of PE, and if they don't, they won't?
Well, it varies from school district to school district, but typically It depends a great deal on whether the teacher finds a way to do it, and there's not much institutional support for it.
Even though it's the law.
Even though it's the law.
Well, so what's the reaction from teachers to your lawsuit? Because I can imagine there'd be a couple of reactions. One, yay, yes, I do want my kids to have PE. But then B, I can't do this. I have so much work to do. I can't also add in PE every day.
We hear a little bit of the, it's a challenge, but we hear much more of the yay. Except when we actually ask in a context where the district is going to hear what the teacher says. And then the teachers tend to say, well, I really shouldn't say too much. The teachers, this is something the teachers want. They just don't feel very supported providing it.
So what happens when you get these logs back and you see that the teachers are not providing the minimum hours of PE to their kids?
Well, I think what's more likely to happen is their principal will say, now, wait a minute, we're going to be sharing these logs with people. We want you to really provide that PE. I'm hoping that the enforcement will come mainly from the fact that people know they're being looked at.
In the meantime, what do you recommend for teachers who say, look, I'm getting all this pressure to teach my kids stuff that they can pass standardized tests so that they can get into college later on, so that they can get good grades? I'm not trained in physical education. What do you say to them when they say, this isn't my job?
I don't think many teachers are saying, this isn't my job. I think some teachers are saying, I'm not getting enough support for it. The administration doesn't care whether I do it. If I say I want to do it, then the administration tells me I'm taking away time from academic subjects. And I think a teacher in that situation should go and say, look, I believe this physical education is important. I think it needs to be done. But beyond that, it is the law. So you're going to need to support me in doing it. And I hope that now administrators will be willing to listen readily to teachers who say, we really need to do this.
And PE, just to be clear, is distinct from recess.
Right. Recess is very important, too. But PE is something distinct. It's an opportunity to engage in something more organized, to learn a sport. For many kids, kids who aren't as privileged especially, PE really represents the one opportunity to learn a sport. I think sometimes some of the administrators who are typically more privileged, who have much higher incomes, who earn $100,000 or $200,000 a year, lose track of the fact that for parents in their class who don't have the same privilege, PE provides an important opportunity to learn how to engage in sports activity. Maybe the principal's kids, you know, go to a private program and learn after school. Maybe they play soccer. Maybe they go to dance. But especially for kids who don't have advantages, PE is very important. And those are precisely the kids who are more likely to be obese because they're given fewer opportunities.
Yeah, I know that in some wealthier public schools here in Los Angeles, the parents pay extra so that they can hire a PE instructor.
Right. And it's wrong that other kids can't get that too. Every kid should have that.
Don Driscoll, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don Driscoll, he's an attorney working with the group Cal 200, which is suing school districts across California to make sure kids get their required PE time. While some schools may have been putting too little emphasis on PE, others may be putting too much importance on computer coding. Legislation is pending in Kentucky that would let high schoolers get foreign language credit for learning to program computers. New Mexico is considering similar legislation, and it's already the law in Texas. The idea is that learning to code will help students prepare for the jobs of the future. But just because HTML and Java are called languages, does that mean they are the same as learning a spoken foreign language? Ironically, some opponents of these pro-code laws, are the most pro-code people, like Hadi Partovi. He's the co-founder of Code.org. That's a nonprofit dedicated to getting more kids into computer science. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Madeline.
So you're all about making computer science more accessible to kids, but you aren't excited about the idea of these laws?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons. You know, we're interested in computer science as something that all kids learn in a foundational manner. And computer science is more about learning how technology works, how algorithms work, how the internet works. That's not really a foreign language. And in fact, the computer languages that are used for typing code into computers ends up being how you implement things. But the learning that goes into that is much more algorithmic and logical and very different than the cultural learning from learning a language like French and Spanish. And these are very different things.
But it is a way, maybe a backdoor way, to get kids to learn about coding, which I guess a lot of people think is important for the future when there just aren't enough hours in the day to learn new things, right?
That's certainly true. And we first of all, haven't been pushing for computer science to be mandated to kids anyway. But to the extent that taking that class satisfies an existing mandate, we very much believe that computer science classes should qualify towards either the math or science strands. A disadvantage of allowing them to satisfy the foreign language credit is, you know, in most states, foreign language can only be taught by a foreign language certified teacher. So a certified Spanish teacher may not be really great to be teaching computer science. And then after you meet that foreign language requirement at the high school level, you may have trouble getting into college because your college that you want to apply to doesn't interpret your CS class as meeting their foreign language requirements. So, you know, on the one hand, it could be a backdoor way to get more people approaching the field, but it may also be a means that causes the wrong teacher teaching it and preventing you from getting into college, which doesn't seem right.
Well, okay, so step back a little bit. And why do you think it's important for kids to learn code anyway? I mean, you know, for example, I drive a car, but I don't know how to build an engine, but
That's a great question. And in fact, even though my organization is called code.org, I think it's important for kids to understand computer science, which is a little bit different than learning to code. And I think that because, you know, when I went to school, I learned how to dissect a frog and how electricity works and how photosynthesis works and also how, you know, a mechanical engine works. But I didn't become an electrician or a botanist or a car mechanic. But learning all those things are part of seeing how the world fits together. And that foundational level, including in technology and software, I think, is not something that all kids need to learn. You don't question, why is my kid learning to dissect a frog? He's not interested in being a surgeon. And I think the same thing applies to technology today. Everybody wants to know how apps work and have at least a chance to maybe consider making one. And not having them even have the option to learn that in school seems un-American to me.
Well, I don't know if everyone wants to know how apps work. I mean, biology is something that we all share. And by dissecting a frog, you learn about your own biology.
I think if you ask kids, all kids do actually want to know how these things work. Kids these days are more fascinated by apps and games than almost anything else.
Okay. So what do you suggest then when we're talking about a school day where, you know, as we heard in the last segment, there's just a lot to cram in and teachers often don't have the time to do that?
So we think computer science should be integrated in a similar fashion as biology or chemistry, where, you know, at the high school level, you can take a biology course. It's not required and it satisfies your science requirement. And meanwhile, in the elementary school or middle school levels, you don't learn biology, but you learn science. And part of science means learning that bees take nectar from flowers and make honey, and you learn that in third grade. And in middle school, you learn about, you know, mixing chemicals together. And, you know, it's not called chemistry class. It's called science class. So we think elements of computer science can be taught throughout elementary school and middle school, integrated into that schedule, and at the high school level, it should be an option that any kid can take if they want to. And at the high school level, it should contribute to their math or science requirements.
And are there enough qualified instructors out there to do that?
There aren't enough qualified instructors to do that, but that's exactly where code.org comes in. We're training about 1,000 teachers every month to introduce this field. And in fact, in almost any city in the country, if you're an elementary school teacher or the parent of an elementary school teacher, we can, in a weekend, have that teacher learn how to offer a curriculum in their classroom, and 100% of it is free to the schools.
Hadi Partovi, an entrepreneur and co-founder of Code.org. That's a nonprofit dedicated to getting more kids into computer science. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Warren Olney, Did you have to dissect a frog in school?
You know, I never did have to dissect a frog. And quite frankly, I was never disappointed that I didn't. I did boil something in a test tube once and the cork flew off.
Well, it certainly
that's about as far as I got in
science. Wasn't a requirement for your current occupation.
Yeah, we're going to talk today about whether there are any good options for the United States in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin and the Russians obviously are moving forward all the time. There's a lot of pressure now on the Obama administration. We'll talk to one former ambassador to Ukraine who's among a group of eight diplomats and former diplomats who are saying it's time for the United States to provide some offensive weapons, as they're referred to. I don't know how there'd be defensive weapons, but they do make that distinction. And we'll talk to Garry Kasparov, a very interesting guy, former chess champion and now a human rights advocate in New York, who has some very, very specific ideas about what it might take or what it will require to come up against Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, and defense secretary nominee looks pretty open to sending in weapons.
He does indeed. Again, always with the proviso that there's no boots on the ground.
Right. All right. Thank you, Warren Olney. Look forward to that discussion at 1 o'clock on To the Point. And coming up before that on this program, the DARE anti-drug program has been in schools for decades, but it doesn't really work. So why do schools still use it and other abstinence-only programs? That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, as we just talked about, with precious few hours in the school day, PE is an endangered species, and schools are struggling with how to cram in newer subjects like computer coding. Yet most states require some sort of drug prevention program to be taught to kids. Here in LA, it's a program called Too Good for Drugs. But one of the biggest drug prevention programs in the country is DARE, and that's an acronym for Drug Abuse Resistance Education. Despite its ubiquity, though, DARE, like many other drug prevention programs, relies on iffy science to teach drug abstinence to children. The abstinence-only approach has been found to be ineffective when it comes to preventing kids from experimenting with drugs and alcohol. Abby Hagledge covers drugs and diseases for The Daily Beast. Hello.
Hi.
Well, give us some examples of the bad science that these programs rely on.
Right. One of the main focuses also of the article was this huge organization called the Foundation for a Drug-Free World, and they are a great example of sort of used drug education gone wrong, and their website is sort of terrifying homepage of creepy voices and people in sort of cage-like structures.
They said meth would help me get through my exams.
They said sniffing glue was no big deal.
Totally safe.
I could party all night.
They said heroin would be the best high I ever had.
It would help me forget my problems.
He said he'd love me forever if I smoked crack with him.
And they're talking about promoting these facts or sort of masking them as facts that aren't true about drugs such as heroin causes spontaneous abortions or marijuana triggers birth defects and infertility, even going into the area of non-recreational drugs, talking about antidepressants, you know, making people so violent that they kill themselves or kill others.
And this Foundation for a Drug-Free World, this program is in New York City schools?
It is. It was taking place in California as well. This program was being promoted about 10 years ago, and sort of a similar uprising happened that's happening now in New York, where people said, hold up, this doesn't seem right. And it was sort of banned from schools in California. Now in New York, it's kind of just leaking out that this is linked to Scientology. It's very difficult to tell on the website or in any of the pamphlets that it is sponsored by Scientology, but I reached out to the foundation directly, and they did confirm it.
How's it linked?
The Church of Scientology is the main sponsor of this foundation, basically, which is a nonprofit foundation, but has really a ton of resources, has sent out 50 million drug prevention books, held tens of thousands of drug awareness events in 180 different countries. I think they've aired commercials on 500 different television stations. They have a pretty wide reach that has, I think, been directly the result of some money from the Church of Scientology.
And then DARE has been around for a long time. So it has sort of this imprimatur of being around for a long time, and so people just reflexively go to it?
Exactly. DARE has been around for decades now, and I think it has gained sort of this, in people's minds, it is seen as a very trusted source and something that everybody kind of went through. But if you actually go back and look at the data and see what's been happening with kids in schools and drug use, teen drug use did not decrease with the invention of DARE, and it certainly isn't working now.
And is that because it relies on complete abstinence as the key to drug prevention?
Yeah, so what both DARE and the Foundation for a Drug-Free World and others do, they really operate on this assumption that zero tolerance is the only way that they can teach kids about drugs is to first say, you can never do them, and here's why. And the problem with that is it doesn't deal with the reality that we live in a world where kids are surrounded by drugs, and at some point, statistics show that they will probably experiment with them, or at least a good deal of them will. And by promoting this zero tolerance, it leaves no room for a conversation as to, you know, what the harmful effects may be if you try it or if you don't. It's just sort of the door is closed. You can't try it, and there's no one to talk to about if you do because you've broken that rule.
Mm. Well, there are now plenty of scientifically backed studies that could be used instead, studies that show problems in developing brains when kids use alcohol or marijuana. I mean, there are many reputable studies that have shown decreased cognitive functioning that could be permanent. So why don't they use that instead?
Right. There is great data that's happening right now that they should be using. The NIDA's Monitoring the Future survey from the past year found that actually the perceived risk of marijuana use among 8th graders, 10th graders, and 12th graders went down, which, given the studies that we've seen on how it can affect the brains of young individuals that use it, that's exactly the opposite of what should be happening. They need to know that this is more dangerous for them, especially. So I think that there are some drug policy organizations trying to get in there and spread awareness about the right way to do this. But kids are smart, and these scare tactics aren't exactly working.
Yeah, and they're anti-authoritarian, or at least they're trying to buck authority or learning the limits. And so when they see these kinds of all or nothing messages, I could see how they would instantly be turned off.
Exactly.
Are there any drug prevention programs in schools that are working and take a more realistic approach?
There are some. So one of the main ones is from the Drug Policy Alliance. That program, Safety First, it takes a more pragmatic approach to drug education, and it focuses on treating these students with compassion and education and treating them really with integrity. And that is working well. I believe they're in a variety of states now. But is there one central big DARE type or Foundation for a Drug-Free World that's doing it right? Unfortunately, no.
And what does the Drug Policy Alliance say? What is their message?
The Drug Policy Alliance, basically, they are sort of respecting and acknowledging that some level of teen drug use is inevitable and obviously not optimal, but just accepting sort of the reality of that is the baseline of their education. So instead of spending the time trying to persuade these kids not to do something that they may already do, it's giving them tools to say, here are the dangers, here's what's going to happen. Ideally, you won't try these, but if you do, here's what you need to know. I think that it really just, the bottom line is it treats them more like young adults, which is what they are, instead of kids.
So like treating it more like sex education, like, yeah, you'll probably experiment. Here's
exactly
what you need to know.
Yeah, one of my sources compared the current drug education of just showing them these graphic, terrible images and people saying, like, I thought he would love me forever if I did crack. He said trying to teach youth about drugs this way is like trying to teach driver's ed by just sitting someone down and showing them a picture of wrecked vehicles and never taking them out in a car. They're not going to learn how to drive. It's like you need to actually just accept that there may be some experimenting happening and help them do that in a safe way if it must.
But I can imagine parents and maybe school administrators not taking too kindly to that message.
Absolutely. I mean, it definitely may rattle some people, the idea that you're admitting that drug use may go on. But in reality, it's the safest option in order to keep people educated.
Abby Haglidge, reporter for The Daily Beast, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, D. I want to try. A more have an attitude.
like that Dare theme song.
That's my jam.
Myers.
That's on my workout mix. So many of us had to do some sort of DARE-like program in school, so clearly our listeners had plenty to say about drug prevention programs. Monster Taco tweeted that for him, DARE was pretty much just a t-shirt. You'll recall the iconic black on red DARE shirts. Monster Taco still has his from when he was a kid. TMC also tweeted us. He says that Just Say No drug education is inept and ineffective. They need to toss it out in schools. Nathan Solis tweets that the officer that came to his school to teach drug prevention, this guy talked to the kids like they were already criminals. If anything, the program had a negative impact. It made them feel like they were already on the wrong side of the law. But SJ Valkyrie thought the anti-drug program actually helped. For SJ, it helped to confirm his or her not for me attitude that SJ already had, made them feel like they were part of a bigger movement in a group. Over on Facebook, Christian Hokinson says that his drug prevention program didn't work one bit. If anything, they did more to introduce us to drugs than discourage us from doing the drugs, he says. I think somebody in our meeting this morning was talking about that, how they like basically showed them what a joint looked like in
they'd
the
never seen them before.
Yeah, so perhaps Christian Hokinson isn't the only one who feels that way.
All right, thanks, Julie Myers. If you want to talk about that, you can. Our Facebook is KCRW Press Play. Our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney and To The Point is up next at 1 o'clock. Have a great afternoon. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.